Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Thursday, and welcome once again to Cresta in the Afternoon. Of course, you know by now Al is back in town. He did get called out of the office last minute to deal with an issue. He will be back tomorrow, Lord willing, and we, will be spending most of tomorrow, or at least part of tomorrow, talking about the March for Life. We've got other great stuff to talk about today and tomorrow as well, and we'll be also talking later on this week about the one-year anniversary of President Biden's inauguration. He, of course, had a very extensive press conference yesterday. We've been looking at some of the reaction to that, not going over so well, and that's something that's probably coming up tomorrow. But today, we have lots of other things to talk about here on Cresta in the Afternoon, including putting atheism on trial. This is an ongoing discussion that's really important to keep in front of us, which is this whole idea of, I guess you'd call it, the problem of evil. And of course, after 9/11, we saw this new wave of combative atheism emerging, claiming to have a more enlightened and accurate worldview than that of historic Christianity. How do we respond to those kinds of claims? Well, Louis Marcos joins us. As I said, we're putting atheism on trial. And then kicking things off in the next hour, we'll look at the origin of the scriptures. Special commentary from Al. This is actually responding to a question he got from a listener who was asking, what role did Mary have in the writing of the Gospels? And how do we know that the Gospels are accurate? Al explains all of that at the 5-1 segment later on in this program. And finally, we'll be discussing the tech-wise family. Technology is a wonderful tool, but it can also be distracting. It can be overwhelming when your phone is constantly pinging at you with those notifications, and it can even be harmful when it's used improperly. Not just talking, of course, about issues with pornography or issues with hate speech online. Lots of different reasons why technology can be a blessing and a curse. But when we make these good decisions about technology, it involves developing wisdom. It involves developing character in the way we use this digital media. And it's not something that's just for kids. Andy Crouch will be joining us, talking about how we can go beyond technology's promise of instant gratification. Andy's the author of The TechWise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place. That's in the next hour. First, let's put atheism on trial with Louis Marcos after this news break.
Thank you, Brian, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 20th. It's the Feast of Saint Sebastian. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. A long-awaited report on the handling of abuse cases in Germany's Archdiocese of Munich has faulted Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI and Cardinal Reinhard Marx for allowing abusers to remain in ministry. The study criticized the Pope's handling of 4 abuse cases when he led the Archdiocese. 2 of these cases involved priests who committed acts of abuse and remained in ministry even after they faced criminal punishment in secular courts. Benedict submitted more than 80 pages of material to the law firm that authored the study and denies that he played any role in a cover-up. Thousands of pro-lifers are headed to Washington, D.C. for tomorrow's March for Life, which is in person once again after last year's virtual event. Organizers say they expect excitement for the march to be at an all-time high with Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization before the Supreme Court. They say they're hopeful the case will bring the country closer to the culture of life. Those who support the unborn have worked since Roe v. Wade was imposed nearly 50 years ago. The FAA is warning that 5G restrictions may impact aircraft landings in bad weather. There are low visibility concerns at a number of U.S. airports. The FAA fears customer 5G cell phone signals could interfere with crucial aircraft equipment. And St. Irenaeus is one step closer to being the first martyr to be declared a doctor of the church. Pope Francis met with the Congregation for the Cause of Saints today and found him worthy of the title. The Pope has called him a great spiritual and theological bridge between Eastern and Western Christians. St. Irenaeus is a bishop and writer revered by both Catholics and Orthodox Christians and known for refuting the heresies of Gnosticism with the defense of both Christ's humility and divinity. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 20 years, we've had an outburst of a new wave of attacks against Christianity and faith in God. It's sometimes called the new atheism. And it seems to have come into, well, it's gathered momentum in the aftermath of the 9/11 destruction of the World Trade Center. And my guest is Dr. Louis Marcos. He's the author most recently of Atheism on Trial. Lou's been a professor of English and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. He's delivered hundreds of lectures worldwide on topics such as apologetics, the worldview of C.S. Lewis and Dante. He's also published Apologetics for the 21st Century and Atheism on Trial, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God. Lou, good to have you back. It's been too long.
It has indeed been too long, Al. It's great to be back in these troubled times.
Yeah. Well, did you notice, too, that this new atheism really seemed to come in the wake of the collapse of the World Trade Center after 9/11?
You know, it really did. I hadn't quite thought about it that way, but it's really been about a 20-year run.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I really think that, you know, it threw people's faith so much that it gave these new atheists a sort of in
right.
to become the voice,
yeah.
right? In other words, you know, no longer are you going to turn to your priest for answers.
Right.
Now you're going to turn to us. I mean, already they were telling us we needed to turn to the scientists. But now let's turn to these people that are not really scientists. I mean, they're educated, but they're somewhere between professor and pundit. And now suddenly they're going to be the ones that are calling the shots.
Right.
And one of the things that pains me, Al, is when you walk into a bookstore, which may not be around much longer anyway, but you walk into a bookstore and you go to the religion section,
right.
and as much as a half of the religion section are new atheist books by Dawson or Richard Dawkins
right.
or somebody like that.
I did it.
Really,
I was there Saturday.
I
was actually there Saturday. I went to a store on the west side of Ann Arbor, and I couldn't believe it. They had in this particular store, they didn't have a very good religion section at all, but roughly half the volumes there were books by Richard Dawkins. His most recent one, I think, is Outgrowing God. And it's a shame. They had the scholar Bart Ehrman, too, New Testament scholar who's an agnostic or atheist.
It is terrible.
Is it?
And to make it worse, half of them are agnostics, and then about 25% of them are people like Bart Ehrman,
yeah.
who somehow people think are giving us the Christian position, as if he believes any more than Bishop Spong or any of these
right.
other John Dominic Crossan or any of these people that don't really believe anything.
Yeah.
They're probably a worse danger to us, but we'll talk about them on another day.
Yeah.
We'll focus on the new atheists today.
Yeah, let's take a look at that. The book is broken up into four basic categories. Category one deals with the nature of the universe. Category two deals with the nature of knowledge. Category three, the nature of God. And category four, the nature of man. I know that you've appreciated ancient Greek and Roman mythology and that you've done some reading in Norse and Egyptian mythology as well. You know, we tend to think of those gods and goddesses as kind of boutique interests for us. But what were the civilizations like that were built on those concepts of God and goddesses?
That's the thing. People need to understand that, you know, what we worship determines what we believe and how we treat other people. And those gods, whether they're the Greco-Roman, the Norse, the Egyptian, they simply cannot stand as a standard for moral, ethical behavior. That is why the, you know, what you might call the virtuous pagans, as Dante called them, people like Socrates or Plato or Aristotle or Cicero,
mm-hmm.
you can see when you read them that they obviously don't know the God of the Bible. They don't know Yahweh. They don't have access to that. But they are clearly moving towards an understanding of monotheism, which not only means one God, it means that if there is a God, that God must be a standard of that which is good and true and beautiful. And without that standard, you really end up with a kind of relativism, what the sophists were teaching, you know, 2,500 years ago. And so the kind of God we worship really determines our actions. In our own AD world, a lot of Enlightenment thinkers, they didn't necessarily throw out God, but they gave us a God who has nothing to do except exist,
right.
What we call the God of deism, the Enlightenment God. Mm-hmm. And in a world like that, for a while, Al, you're going to be able to hold on to real morality, but there is going to be a drift, and we are seeing the upshot of that over the last several years, where we're realizing that the God of moral therapeutic deism cannot hold us to any real kind of standard. It's going to be wishy-washy, and it's going to go away. And even Richard Dawkins is starting to understand this. You know, he's starting to admit that, wow, I mean, if you follow out his theories, we could be in trouble.
Right.
They're kind
right.
of waking up now, but they're still not, of course, abandoning their atheism.
No, hopefully he'll at least arrive at the idea that there's objective moral truths. If he can establish that, maybe he can draw near to the kingdom. I don't know. But
yeah, because I think he's realizing that you need them. I mean,
right.
pretty soon anything goes. And, you know, what we're seeing with transgenderism today is the ultimate proof that anything goes. I guess Cole Porter was right. there's no standard, right? And I'll tell you, Al, the real reason that impelled me to write this book, but my original title was Nothing New Under the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
The publisher came up, and, you know, how can you complain? Atheism on Trial is really, really catchy. But my original vision was Nothing New Under the Sun. It annoys me, and I'm still seeing it today, that the new atheists, they write as if what they are saying in their book is based on some kind of new research,
yes,
some new discoveries
right.
in science or history or biology or anthropology, whatever it is. And in fact, Al, there is nothing new under the sun. They are recycling the same atheist and agnostic and deistic arguments that have been around for thousands of years.
Right.
And not only have they been around for thousands of years, Al, they've been answered for that long.
Yep.
Sometimes by Christians, like Augustine or Aquinas, mm-hmm. but a lot of them were answered by, again, these virtuous pagans, people like Plato and Aristotle and Cicero. So there's nothing new. And if I could give you a quick analogy
yeah,
to
please.
This, what drives me crazy is when you take a class on Bible, right, and they start throwing something at you like JPE, you know, even though that's been pretty much disproven.
Yeah, this whole documentary hypothesis.
Still hold on to it.
Right.
Yeah, so sad, right? But whenever they do that, whenever they want to start messing with the Bible, what they do to the undergraduate and even the graduate is they speak in such a way as if to make you think that their theories are based on some kind of new research that you don't have access to.
Right.
But
right.
if you really push it, you'll realize that, okay, maybe they know Greek and Hebrew, but you don't. But other than that, they're looking at the Gospels. That, you know, this whole, you know, Bart Ehrman stuff, they're just looking at the same Gospels you are.
Right.
But they want to intimidate you to think, there's some new thing that you don't know about. Actually, all the new things, especially the Big Bang and all these other things, are actually pointing in favor of God.
That's
most
right.
of the new discoveries are in favor of God, not against them. You remember, Al, when the Dead Sea Scrolls came out, and of course they took forever to release them.
Right.
They kept telling, this is going to, you know, drive a hole right through Christianity. And no, once they were really translated and objective people looked at them, what they told us was, the gospel's presentation of first century Palestine is accurate.
Right, right. No, exactly. You're absolutely right. There's this popular, it happens time and again, popular culture and the popular press will seize on some new discovery which is supposed to somehow shake the faith of the old religion. And we're all supposed to be, you know, shaking in our boots, wondering what the future will hold. What's funny is that the Big Bang itself turns out to really serve the purpose of Christian apologetics. Explain that to us.
It really has. And we need to remember that as the evidence for the Big Bang was mounting, a lot of scientists that were atheists or agnostic, including Einstein, resisted it.
Right.
Because they understood the theistic implications of the Big Bang. And they wanted what they called a steady state, this idea that the universe has always been here.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to believe it. You probably know that Einstein was resisting the idea of the universe expanding, because if it's been expanding for millions of years, then it must have had a beginning.
Right.
And he came up with, some people call it the fudge factor, some way to get around it. And later on, he realized he was wrong. It was kind of embarrassing. But again, he was doing it not for scientific reasons, but for metaphysical reasons. Right. He wanted to be able to, and you know, some of the new atheists have even admitted it now. They admitted that they don't want God to be true so they can do whatever they want to do, especially in the sexual realm when they were younger. But the evidence is there. If the universe has a beginning, and again, some people misunderstand the Big Bang as if the void was there and the Big Bang went off and filled it with matter. But actually, before the Big Bang, there was simply nothing.
Right.
There was no void and there was no matter. There wasn't even any time. All of these things happened at this incredible moment, bursting into being. And there must be something outside of the Big Bang to get it started. Now, as a lot of people know, as for instance, Stephen Hawking. You know, at first, with the brief history of time, in the beginning, he was one of the biggest proponents of the Big Bang.
Right.
And then suddenly, it must have struck him that, wait a minute, this is theistic, right? And yeah. So he starts coming up and others with this idea of the multiverse, which mm-hmm. works great in science fiction, but it's really nonsense, right? And this is what, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, New York, the word chutzpah, okay? And the new atheist has chutzpah because unable to explain how one universe came into being without God, they think they'll get around that by theorizing that millions of universes came into being.
Right.
Now that's chutzpah, Al. This is great.
No, that is, you can't explain. So you can't explain this universe, so now you want to explain multiple universes. The same problems are, you're going to have the same problems.
Yeah, but they have nothing. And if you start reading it, people like Stephen Hawking were actually saying, you know, John Lennox grabbed a hold of him and showed him how foolish he was, saying things like, well, all we need is something like the theory of gravity, and that will fix everything. Well, there's two problems. First of all, before the Big Bang, there was nothing, okay,
right.
including the law of gravity.
Right.
But
right.
But there's another, even bigger problem. He acts as if the law of gravity has the potential to create something. The law of gravity is just a measure of something that already exists. So the law of gravity is meaningless if there's no matter in,
exactly.
in movement. So, but the fact that someone of the towering intelligence of Stephen Hawking would try to push that off
mm-hmm.
shows you a sort of desperation.
Yeah, end-of-life desperation. You know, yeah. No, I think that was his final effort. Lou, hold it there. We'll come back, continue the conversation. My guest, Dr. Louis Marcos, the book, Atheism on Trial, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God. I'm Al Cresta. We'll be right back.
Christ is the Answer with Father John Ricardo.
Are you passionate about Jesus? Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him? Is that true? It's not true for most people in the church. Is Jesus my best friend? Is he your best friend? I'm looking around the church. There's a set of guys in here who have great man caves. As I was praying this morning, I felt like the Lord said, hey, when are you going to come to my man cave? Like, you guys think a flat screen TV is really cool. Well, you should see what I got to offer. Because I and I alone, he says, can really give you what it is you're longing for. Whoever it is we're rooting for right now, they're going to lose eventually. Or whatever it is that's occupying our time, one day we're going to realize it really wasn't that important. Why aren't we hanging out with the one who alone can show us what life is really all about? When was the last time you hung out in the Lord's man cave?
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You remember the time I sent on the air? Go to confession. And when you're done, go out and have a big ice cream soda. Celebrate. And a man wrote to me, he said, you know, I hadn't gone to confession in 30 years. Do you mind if I went and had a pizza? I said, oh, have 20 pizzas.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. Maybe you've even prayed the prayer of spiritual communion. Spiritual communion is a concept that goes all the way back to the 4th century. It flourished in the Eastern Church and gradually moved west. Spiritual communion stresses the transcendence of God, where we unite our desires, intentions, and loves with the holy sacrifice of the Mass and the consecration of the Eucharist at the altar. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Who was the first Catholic in your family tree? Why did they choose to join the church? Was it the recommendation of a friend, a coworker, maybe a neighbor? Did you ever think that you could be that person who forever changes the lives of someone and their children, grandchildren, and generations to come? St. Paul's Street Evangelization invites you to consider this fact and join the thousands of evangelists who go out to invite people into a relationship with Jesus and his church. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more about how you can become a life changer.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Louis Marcos. Atheism on trial, refuting the modern arguments against God. Lou, you mentioned John Lennox last segment going toe-to-toe with Stephen Hawking. You know, I think many times Christians don't realize that there are, in fact, Christian scholars out there that are quite capable of taking on any of these celebrated atheists. And I know that that's been something I've enjoyed watching over the years.
I love John Lennox. And, you know, it's funny. You know, there's a lot of great British apologists, but one of the things that drives me crazy is almost none of the British apologists will ever speak out against Darwin. They're just too scared, I guess. Only John Lennox will actually speak out. And I never could figure out why until I met him in person and realized he's Irish. He's not English. He's Irish. He's got a fighting spirit with a great accent. And I'm like, yeah, you're ready to go out and smash him and don't care what they think about you. The guy's just great. And I know there's a new documentary movie out where he's talking about God. I can't remember the title right now, with Kevin Sorbo. But just recently a new one came out. And they're there. I mean, we've got some heavy hitters out there.
Right.
And what's his name? The one that wrote the Signature of the Cell, Stephen,
Stephen Meyer.
No, I'm talking Stephen Meyer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Stephen Meyer is just, I've been, you know, going back and forth on YouTube, and he's starting to get a lot of respect, even from thinkers that are atheists.
Yeah.
They're not ready to be theists, but they're starting to say, you know, you've got some pretty good arguments here, okay?
And
his arguments are not only based on the Bible. They're based on the science. They're based on what we observe and what is the best way to explain the evidence that we see and the evidence that's all around us. So intelligent design has really grown, and it's exciting, and you know, they're starting to force us to look at the complexity of the universe, right? And, you know, they have this idea of specified complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? There is complexity in the world that doesn't need intelligence. For example, certain crystals, which are very, very complex, right? But what specified complexity means is when you have something that is complex and you can link it to something outside of that thing itself. It's not just complicated, it's a complexity that points outside of itself. So the example that's often used is if you're walking through South Dakota and you see a rock and it's got a certain curve that sort of looks like a nose and sort of looks like a chin, and you know that could have been the weathering of rock, which is an evolutionary force. It's blind and it doesn't have any, it's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But you continue to walk and suddenly you see another rock that has four recognizably human faces on it, and those human faces match up with four presidents, and you realize it's Mount Rushmore, and it is a product of intelligent design.
Right.
It has specified complexity, and that is what we see not only on the macro level in terms of the fine-tuning of the universe, it's something we see on the micro level in our DNA and the molecular machines that are running everything. It's just an unbelievable complexity. And you know, Al, that first of all, what we call Darwinism today is actually against Darwin, because Darwin himself said nature takes no leaps.
Right.
Everything's got to be slow, gradual
right.
change. Well,
right.
we realize not only does that not work, there's not enough time. I mean, the Big Bang has now put a limit of, 4.5 billion years for our Earth. That may sound like a lot of time, but that doesn't begin to give enough time for the kind of Darwinian evolution Darwin was pushing for. So they need a sort of punctuated equilibrium from Stephen
right,
Jay Gould,
right.
a mixture of Darwinism with basically things that sort of leap, mutations that leap things forward. Now, once we've learned about our DNA, and we realize that every time the DNA replicates itself, there is a possibility for mutation. Suddenly, the neo-Darwinian fusion jumps on that and says, aha, I've got it. Now, here's the funny part. Even if you could argue that the way our DNA replicates might give the possibility of a kind of evolution, the thing that could not have evolved is the DNA itself.
Right.
You can't have DNA-driven evolution until you have the specified complexity and front-loaded information that's loaded into the DNA.
Yeah. At the very bottom, there's information. Yeah. At the very bottom of it, there's information.
That's it. All the way down to the very bottom, we get information. And, of course, we should have known this, because if anybody sits down and reads Origin of the Species by Darwin, you'll see that the most common analogy he makes, the sort of running analogy to explain things to us, is breeding of animals.
Yeah.
But the breeding of animals and plants is intelligent design. It's driven by a human mind that not only understands the complexity, but has an endpoint, a telos, as the Greeks called it, towards which it's going. And so, again, it drives me crazy when you read Richard Dawkins, because all of these people, well, you know, David Attenborough, when he talks about animals, he shows you all this unbelievable design and complexity.
Yep.
And then always comes the punchline. Of course, this is just the appearance of design.
I love it. I've always loved that. Yeah.
And they take it back. It's really crazy. But again, we need to understand as Christians that the science is really in our favor. The more we understand, and it started with the number-crunching cosmologists when they started looking at the evidence and realized that, you know, statistically it's just impossible. I mean, the statistical possibility of this happening is like throwing a dart and hitting one atom in the universe, right? And, of course, you have to keep doing that again and again. It just doesn't work. And I don't know, I kind of get tired of this after a while.
Well, it's gone on. I remember back when I was an undergraduate, Murray Eden at the Wistar Institute was already arguing that mathematically speaking, it was impossible to reach the level of complexity we've got in the visible universe today, given the amount of time that was being specified for it. And so that's a long time ago when I was an undergraduate.
Yeah, yeah.
So and yet you continue to hear, I mean, the Christians make the case for, this specified complexity or irreducible complexity when it comes to biological systems. We talk about the extraordinary unlikelihood of a life-affirming universe, or especially a life-affirming planet. And it's on the face of it, it's darn impressive. But
for some reason or other, there seems to be a decided a refusal to accept what to most, you know, commonsensical people indicates design. They call it the appearance of design. Well,
right.
Show me.
We have to break ourselves. We've been sort of brainwashed to believe. We brainwashed ourselves to believe that science is necessarily objective. Okay? And well, scientists are not objective. Okay? Scientists also, and I say an agenda, but I'm not talking politically here. They have an agenda in that they don't want the theism to be true.
Right.
Because they don't want to be accountable.
Yeah.
Like most people, we don't want to be accountable. We want to do what we want to do. That's why I love, of course, C.S. Lewis says that's why the best religion of all is pantheism, the idea that sort of everything is God. And the reason that is the ultimate wish fulfillment, as Freud would say, is if you have a universe that's God, that means that when the sun is shining and everything's beautiful and you're all happy and you look up and you just want to thank somebody and celebrate the universe. But then when you want to do something really low and questionable, then it's nice to know that the universe really doesn't care.
Right?
So we've got this. But I'll tell you, I really think, as I look back at my book, that the most important chapter on my book is the chapter on Marcionism. I'll explain what I mean by that. Right now, the new atheists, the people, they know that they're on slippery sand. They know that the science is going against them more and more, that we learn about history and archaeology and all these things. More and more, it's going against them. They're painting themselves in the corner. And that is why, Al, I believe that over the last 10 years or so, the argument they fall back on again and again is God is evil, right?
Yeah.
That famous or infamous paragraph in The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, where he levels at God every name in the book, racist, sexist, homophobic, suicidal, on and on and on. And of course, he's speaking specifically of the God of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's the only way they can get by now. They keep falling back on the conquest of Canaan, right? Or the flood. And so, okay, maybe there is a God, but he's a genocidal maniac,
right?
Now, they fall back on that because it's got an emotional power to it,
mm-hmm.
and it allows them to edge their way. See, it used to be that if you wanted to avoid Christianity, you just had to find a Christian who was a hypocrite. And then you could get out of it and say, well, if this is Christianity, it's not true. Now they've sort of, that's not working anymore. So now we're going to just look at God himself, okay? This God of the Old Testament. Now, here's the thing that's amazing, Al. That argument that basically the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament are totally different gods, that the God of the Old Testament is this angry tribal deity zapping people, just nasty. Well, what does he say? The most unpleasant creation in all literature is what Dawkins says.
That's right.
That's the old. And then the New Testament God is the God of love. Jesus, meek and mild, how sweet, all that sort of stuff. You know, suffer the little children to come unto me. All right. Whenever they say that, they have this look on their face like they just invented that idea. Oh, the Hillsong, that crazy guy decides to go, he's like, oh my gosh, I just realized that hell is a nasty idea. Do we Christians really believe it? I mean, it's unbelievable the things they say.
Yeah.
Or one of my favorites is the modern fight over the problem of pain, of theodicy, kind of goes back to when Voltaire reacted to the
Lisbon earthquake
like 250 years ago. And it's almost like he said, oh, look at that. Now I can see God is not a nice guy, as if there was never a natural disaster before. These people are crazy. I mean, what are you talking about? Okay, let me come back. So this idea, this desire to split God in two, Old Testament, New Testament, angry, loving. It's not only in William Blake 200 years ago. It's in one of the first great Christian heretics,
right.
A bishop named Marcion, and we're talking about 1800 years ago now. Al, this was one of the earliest and most dangerous heresies in the early church that had to be fought, and that is exactly what Marcion said. He basically threw out the Old Testament. And
right.
When we come back, maybe we'll talk about the answer.
We will. My guest, Dr. Lewis Marcos, Atheism on Trial: Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God.
I'm Al Cresta.
Support for this Ave Maria program comes in part by the not-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Shopping for insurance, mortgage products, Catholic health coverage, identity protection, or financial planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for all those and more. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US-1.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Are you looking for peace? Longing for joy? Want to meet the giver of all goodness? God is calling the laity to bring Ignatian prayer into the suffering world. Work for the new evangelization. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com. Order your free digital training and manual. Find true happiness and everlasting joy. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
And click on the red button today.
It's free. Approved by the USCCB.
Nestled under the warm Florida sun is a university whose name indicates a vocational call. Ave Maria, Latin for Hail Mary, recalls the angel Gabriel's announcement to Mary of her future vocation, becoming the Mother of God. Enriched by God's grace, Mary freely ascends to this call. This is the model for all students. Come to Ave Maria University, where you'll be empowered to clearly see your vocational call, whatever that call might be. Ave Maria University, your vocation location. Visit avemaria.edu.
With so much going on in the world, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. What do you need to know today? Stay tuned to Cresta in the Afternoon and Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo as we bring you the day's top stories and conversations from an authentic Catholic perspective. Never miss an episode of Cresta in the Afternoon. Subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand at AveMariaRadio.net and on the Ave Maria Radio app.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We have to remember that God gave us a brain, and He did give us talented people in the medical field, some of whom, not all unfortunately, are following the science. And we need to do the same. We need to take precautions and, again, use common sense and our heads. But we can't go around living in fear, not doing what we are called to do. And in many cases, that is to travel, to go see loved ones, to go on a retreat, to maybe go on a pilgrimage. We have to be, at all times, a people of faith. And we have to remember that the phrase, be not afraid, appears some 365 times in Scripture. Coincidence? I think not.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
What is the great mystery of the Christian faith? It is, of course, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Even though the resurrection is an historical fact professed by the apostles and signified by the empty tomb, no one knows the exact hour Jesus emerged from the tomb. There were no eyewitnesses to describe the actual moment, only the result, the live appearances of Jesus to his disciples. It is an event that transcends and surpasses history, the Catholic Catechism tells us. The three persons of the Trinity, using their individual characteristics, acted as one in bringing about the resurrection. God the Father raised up the Son. God the Holy Spirit gave life to Jesus' dead humanity and called it to the glorious state of lordship. The Son effects his own resurrection by virtue of his divine power. He predicted the Passion and declared that he had the power to lay down his life and take it up again. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Louis Marcos. Atheism on Trial, the name of the book, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God. Before the break, we were talking about modern Marcionism. Lou's quoting from the celebrated atheist Richard Dawkins, who said, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal,
filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. That's a great string of adjectives there. Okay. This is part of the old heresy that the God of the Old Testament was somehow cruel and vindictive, a lesser God than the God of the New Testament, which is the God of the New Testament, of course, characterized by love, forgiveness. This is an old heresy, which we're still dealing with today, although it's been dressed up now in, you know, supposedly scientific garb.
It is. I mean, it's really been around forever. And look, Al, every one of us is a Christian. We come to a moment someday when we're reading the Bible and we're like, oh my gosh, these seem like two different gods. I mean, we all wrestle with that until we read it carefully. And right. We read a book like the book of Ruth, right, or the book of Jonah, and we see God's love for people outside the covenant kingdom of Israel. In fact,
or even Rahab and Joshua.
Rahab. Yeah. Exactly. And Rahab is in the bloodline of Jesus. Rahab, the harlot, Ruth, who's a Moabite, is not even a Jewess, and it becomes part of the bloodline of Christ. We read in the calling of Abraham that I will bless you, God says, but so you will be a blessing to others. We see that. The reason Jonah runs away is he doesn't want to preach the gospel to the Assyrians because he's afraid that they will accept it and repent. And he knows that God is one of those annoying people who listens to people that repent. He wants to see the Assyrians burn, right? He runs literally as far away as he can, probably runs to Spain, a lot of people think, as far away as he can get because he doesn't want God to be merciful. On the other hand, all you have to do is look at the way Jesus interacts with the Pharisees, or for that matter, read the book of Revelation, or for that matter, understand that nobody in the Bible says more about devils and hell than Jesus.
Everybody has
this idea that Paul invented hell. Paul actually says very little about hell. Paul's always talking about grace, right? Jesus is the one who talks about devils and talks about hell and spends an awful lot of time exorcising demons out of people. Right there, we see it. But about 1,800 years ago, Al, there was a great church father named Tertullian. And Tertullian answered Marcion. And he tried to explain that part of the nature of our God is that he is loving, but he's also holy and just. And he is clearly a God who makes commands, and commands that come with punishments if they're broken. And if Marcion is correct, then this poor, pathetic God is a God who makes commands but has no desire and no power to actually execute those commands if we disobey him. You know, what kind of God do you want? Well, Tertullian realized that what Marcion wanted is what we today would call a user-friendly God, or a lot of your listeners may be familiar with a book that talked about the religion of this generation is MTD, moral therapeutic deism.
Right.
They want a God that's there, that will affirm them, that makes them feel good about themselves, but he doesn't really get involved in our lives. You know, he's not like looking over our shoulder. He doesn't really care if we sleep around or anything like that, right? I mean, we're still fighting with this, but we need to understand that if God does not have the power and the will to enforce his laws, what kind of a God is he? He's certainly not a God that can save. And you know what? All of us, whether we're atheists or not, we see injustice in the world and it angers us. But if Marcion is right and if Richard Dawkins is right, then this God of ours has neither the power nor even the desire to end injustice.
Right.
And bring in justice. We just have to keep... What kind of a God do you want?
Well, we become more moral than God, right?
Yeah.
We're more moral than God. That's the assertion.
And I really do think this. This kind of just struck me as a moment of revelation as I looked at this generation. And I'm thinking, what's the problem with this generation? Well, again, the two big issues for young people, one is the whole sexual, the gay, the transgender. But the other one is this, again, this angry Old Testament God, how could he, kill the Canaanites and all that stuff? Well, here's the thing. What it does is, a lot of times, it makes young people and the theologian professors that are teaching them, well, maybe Joshua's not really inspired. Okay, now, this is really dangerous, Al, okay? It's going to make you start questioning the scriptures. But it does something even worse than that. Here I am, a Baptist. I'm going to tell you there's something even worse than doubting the scriptures. Can you imagine that? Okay, so, because I'm in trouble, right? I don't have a pope, right? Scriptures, I'm in big trouble.
That's Alan. Right. That's all you've got. That's all you've got.
That's all we've got. Okay, so hey, when I say this, I really mean it, right? Even more dangerous than young people questioning the authority and inerrancy of scripture is what it is breeding. Is a generation of people who think they are more moral than the God of the Old Testament.
Right.
And that is the sin of pride. That is the worst sin of all. That is the sin of Satan himself. And all the adults are helping to breed this incredibly destructive, not only destructive of Christianity, but destructive of society.
Right.
These young people think that they're more moral than God. And It's very, very dangerous. And like I said, it's really, really funny because things like hell and devils that people don't want to talk about, the traditional way of getting rid of that is just saying that was Paul's idea. But as I said a moment ago, no, Jesus is the one who speaks about judgment. Jesus is the one who goes beyond using the word Hades to speak of hell and starts using the word Gehenna. Right? A lot of us know that was a trash heap that was continually burning. It's
right.
The place where the worshippers of Baal would pass their children through the fire and sacrifice them to this horrible idol deity. Right? And that's the word that Jesus himself uses more than anybody else, Gehenna. So this is a God of justice, right? And here's another. It's just a small little thing, but it's so true. If somebody says to you, there cannot be a God because there's so much injustice in the world, your response is, if there was no God, you would not know that the world was unjust.
Right.
The only way you can know the world is unjust is if you're measuring it against justice.
Some right? standard, right?
But if your God is only a meek and mild God that doesn't want to get in anybody's face, then he cannot be a standard of justice because he's not even willing to uphold justice. He just, oh, there, everything's fine, okay? So the funny thing is that these people that are morally outraged against the God of the Old Testament don't really understand moral outrage because they don't really understand justice or holiness.
No. Well, I think that's true. They don't enter deeply enough into the whole biblical narrative, the whole storyline. That's why they miss that even in the much despised book of Joshua, where you've got the conquest right. narratives, that even there you've got a God who is making room for Rahab the harlot from outside the covenant people, and he's always right. interested in those who are marginalized. Do you think? I mean, you're working with undergraduates and students all the time. Do you think that there is less of a willingness to ask these deeper questions than a generation ago? Are students more flippant today, more self-satisfied?
I think so. And I think, you know, it's just as long as everything goes well. I mean, it's funny now. This makes me reminiscent for the hippies.
Yeah.
Because at least the hippies were really trying to seek something that's authentic.
Right.
And they, almost like early Christians, were willing to give up all their creature comforts to seek the authentic. Right?
Yep.
And you know, I don't condone their sexual sin, but I think they were really trying to seek after intimacy.
Yeah.
Rather than mere self-pleasure, which is what has happened today. It's merely about a sort of narcissistic self-pleasure. I don't want. And what's really bad is that a lot of these kids are going along with cancel culture, not necessarily because they're super progressives, but they also don't mind canceling things because they don't like to be upset. They don't like to have anybody disagree. And so they're willing to have those voices shut down, not necessarily because they're progressives or Marxists or anything, but because it will allow them to just smile and be happy and not have to face things. And we need to, you know, let me just read you something from Tertullian. This is just amazing, okay? This could have been written today. This is what MTD is about. This is Tertullian, 1,800 years ago. He says, with great irony, he says, a better God has been discovered by Marcion, a God who never takes offense, is never angry, never inflicts punishment, who has prepared no fire in hell, no gnashing of teeth in the outer darkness. He is purely and simply good. He indeed forbids all delinquency, but only in word. He is in you if you are willing to pay him homage for the sake of appearances, that you may seem to honor God for your fear he does not want. Could that not have been written yesterday?
Yeah, really. I mean, and it's dripping with sarcasm.
It really is. Oh, he's sarcastic. You know, this is the guy that can be tough. This is the guy who gave us that great phrase, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. He's a pretty tough dude, right? But I think he sees through it right away. And again, because we don't study our church history, we have to keep fighting the same old heresies.
Right.
You know, the famous book, The Da Vinci Code, that's fighting along with something called Gnosticism.
Right.
You know, the church decisively did away with that 1,700 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But because we don't know our history, we don't know our creeds, we don't know our church councils, we're just fighting the same old argument again and again. And you need to understand that Marcionism often goes hand in hand with Gnosticism. And in Gnosticism, what you have is this belief that creation is itself the fall. Not God created the world good and said it is good, said it is very good, and then we disobeyed and fell, but that creation itself is a fall. That some lesser deity that they often link to Yahweh of the Old Testament, that some lesser deity created the world, matter is bad and matter is evil.
Right.
I know in your program,
and we're in bondage.
Chesterton here, right? Here's what Chesterton says. He says, one of the things he loves in people that attack the Catholic Church, he says, in the same breath, they will say, we don't like you Catholics because you tell us that the body is inherently evil and sinful. That's so negative. We don't like that. And another thing we don't like about you is you persecuted those poor Gnostics. Now, do you see the unbelievable hilarity of this, okay?
Yes.
It is the Gnostics who taught that the flesh is evil and inherently fallen and bad, and sexuality is inherently bad, and making babies is really, really bad, okay?
Right.
So that's not what the church said. That's what the Gnostics said, and that's why the church did have to declare them heretical.
Lou, great talking with you again. We will pick up the conversation in the future, okay? Enjoyed being with you today.
I've got a book on mythology, one on Plato, so I'm always
I'll get back in touch with you.
And chat with you, Al.
It's been too much time. All right. Louis Marcos, Atheism on Trial.
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is Stewardship of the Environment, God's Creation of Nature. When you hear the message, be a wise steward of your resources, do you ever consider the role you play in your community environment? It's natural to think of time, talent, and treasure when stewardship is mentioned, but our faith teaches us that all is gift from God. Thus, respect for nature and doing our part to ensure a safe and clean environment is important. Here are just three areas we can pay more attention. A lot of action has been taken in recent years by nonprofits geared towards a cleaner environment. The first area of focus is to eliminate litter. Consider how your actions to pick up after yourself are pleasing to God. Be proud to do your part to keep your community and neighborhood clean. Secondly, look at ways to recycle and make the most out of your purchases. Does it matter to you that so much plastic consumes our landfills? Have you given thought as to how you can make a particular purchase last longer? Third, in a country filled with abundance, what's being done to ensure our nature and environment for the next generation? This is more than eating bread crust and cleaning off your plate. The root lies in not wasting what we've been given. There's a great deal of time and effort that goes into caring for our place of residence in addition to our possessions. keeping up what is ours or giving our used possessions to the less fortunate are a couple of ways to be prudent stewards of our blessings from God. I'm Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.
Thank you for being with us in this first hour of Crest in the Afternoon. If you'd like to learn more about Luis Marcos's books, you can find them in the Crest Augusta archives at AveMariaRadio.net, where we will have his book, Atheism on Trial, Refuting the Modern Arguments Against God, as well as another book he wrote examining the Christian connections to the Roman and Greek mythology. In the next hour, we have more to say. We'll be talking again, looking at the origin of the scriptures and what role Mary played in the writing of the scriptures. And also we'll be discussing the TechWise family with Andy Crouch, looking at how technology can be used more properly by families. Also at AveMariaRadio.net, we've got our poll of the week asking what your plans are for the March for Life this year. And if you go there, we've also got in our slider just for this week lots of very helpful information. If you're planning to go to the march, what do you need to know about masks? What do you need about social distancing? What do you need to know about where to go when you get there? All that stuff for people who maybe are going for the first time this year. A very helpful article from Catholic News Agency that we have linked for you in our slider. Once again, that's at AveMariaRadio.net. And keeping you all in prayer, if you are headed to D.C. right now, or if you're already there, we'll be talking more about that later on this week. We'll see you in the next hour, talking the TechWise family. More to come on Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. Once again, this is Bryant Chainley. As you know, Al was out last week. He is back, but was called out at the last minute to deal with some other issues. He'll be back tomorrow, Lord willing. And we've got lots of great programming tomorrow that we're hopefully going to be able to do that we had originally planned to do today. I will give you one quick sneak peek for tomorrow. Very remarkable story we'll be sharing with you, the life of Father Aloysius Schwartz, now a venerable priest born in the U.S., died in the Philippines, serving the poorest of the poor. And tomorrow, Kevin Wells will be joining us to share his story. Likely tomorrow we'll also be getting some reactions to the first year of President Biden's presidency and his interesting, to say the least, press conference yesterday. And we'll, of course, also be having lots to say tomorrow about the March for Life. If you're headed there right now, or if you're already there, we're certainly keeping you in prayer, as are everybody else who is standing up for life this weekend. In this hour, kicking things off with a commentary from Al on the origin of the scriptures, he'll be explaining what role Mary had, if any, in the writing of the Gospels, and also how do we know that the Gospels are accurate. Obviously, there's a lot more to say there than just what Al will get to in 13 minutes, but this is a good sampling of what there is to say about that topic. And then later on in this hour, we'll be discussing the TechWise family. Technology, I think you'd agree, is a blessing and a curse. Me personally, I use my smartphone a lot for a lot of different things, but there is something nice about just putting it down for a day and getting away and enjoying the silence. And there's lots of good tools out there for helping us use technology more effectively. But it goes beyond just using internet filters or limiting screen time and telling your kids, oh, you have to get off your phone after an hour. There's a lot of ways we can develop wisdom and character in the ways that we use digital media. And as I said, this is certainly not something that's just for kids. Anybody who uses technology, which if you live in 21st century America, it's pretty much everybody, has ways that they can use technology to help them increase in wisdom and virtue. And so Andy Crouch joining us, looking at how we can go beyond technology's promises of instant gratification. He's the author of The Tech Wise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place, and his work has been featured in Time, The Wall Street Journal, and many other places where we'll have linked for you as well in our website. So let's get rolling with the next hour of Cresta in the Afternoon after this news break.
Thank you, Brian, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 20th. It's the Feast of St. Sebastian. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. A long-awaited report on the handling of abuse cases in Germany's Archdiocese of Munich has faulted Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI and Cardinal Reinhard Marx for allowing abusers to remain in ministry. The study criticized the Pope's handling of four abuse cases when he led the Archdiocese. Two of these cases involved priests who committed acts of abuse and remained in ministry even after they faced criminal punishment in secular courts. Benedict submitted more than 80 pages of material to the law firm that authored the study and denies that he played any role in a cover-up. Thousands of pro-lifers are headed to Washington, D.C. for tomorrow's March for Life, which is in person once again after last year's virtual event. Organizers say they expect excitement for the march to be at an all-time high with Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization before the Supreme Court. They say they're hopeful the case will bring the country closer to the culture of life. Those who support the unborn have worked since Roe v. Wade was imposed nearly 50 years ago. The FAA is warning that 5G restrictions may impact aircraft landings in bad weather. There are low visibility concerns at a number of U.S. airports. The FAA fears customer 5G cell phone signals could interfere with crucial aircraft equipment. And St. Irenaeus is one step closer to being the first martyr to be declared a doctor of the church. Pope Francis met with the Congregation for the Cause of Saints today and found him worthy of the title. The Pope has called him a great spiritual and theological bridge between Eastern and Western Christians. St. Irenaeus is a bishop and writer revered by both Catholics and Orthodox Christians and known for refuting the heresies of Gnosticism with the defense of both Christ's humility and divinity. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. I thank you for joining me. Got an email asking a question about New Testament, about the origins of the New Testament. It was actually directed to a question about the Blessed Mother and asking, was Mary alive during the actual writing of the Gospels? If so, did she affect it in any way? And I took the occasion in answering that question to just lay out in a fairly simple way what scholars know about the origins of the New Testament books. And I think it's just fascinating. And one of my great regrets is that neither in the Protestant world or in the Catholic world do priests and pastors take the time to help parishioners and congregants actually understand how we got the New Testament. We know it's 27 books, but most people actually think of it as a single book. It's actually a library of 27 books. And we actually have a fairly good idea that there were other sources that the gospel writers used. So I'm going to go over that now because this is not very controversial at all. But I do think that we've made the mistake of not educating people about this. I know when I was an undergraduate, I became a Christian. And I can remember having to fight my way through these questions with various professors. Now, since that time, the tide of New Testament criticism has really come down on our way, and it's much more conservative today than it was back in the 1970s. So let me go over a few of these things. We have the four Gospels, and we have the letters of James and Paul. Now, all of those six documents contain early allusions and descriptions of Jesus' life and teachings. And we also are confident that we have discerned sources that the gospel writers relied on, and this gives us many sources that attest to the events and teachings of Jesus. The earliest written gospel, and I'm speaking here, this is the consensus of New Testament scholarship. There is a minority position on this.
But the earliest written gospel is generally thought to be Mark. And the bishop of Hierapolis, Papias, who lived from 60 until 130, actually wrote that Mark became Peter's interpreter and wrote accurately all that he remembered. So we've got the Gospel of Mark being basically the memoirs of St. Peter. Catholics believe James was the foster brother of Jesus, and we have an epistle, a letter from James, written somewhere between 50 and 62 AD. It's difficult to actually pin it down. But here's what you may not have heard. The letter of James contains more allusions to the sayings of Jesus than any other New Testament document outside the four Gospels. Now, this makes a lot of sense, because if he was the foster brother of Jesus, you can imagine, for some period of time anyways, him sitting at the feet of his rabbi brother. Let me give you an example of what I mean. In Luke chapter 20, verse 46, Jesus teaches, "Beware of the scribes who like to go about in long robes and love salutations in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts." In James, the second chapter, we've got this. "For if a man with gold rings and in fine clothing comes into your assembly, and a poor man in shabby clothing also comes in, and you pay attention to the one who wears the fine clothing and say, 'Hey, have a seat up here in front, please,' while you say to the poor man, 'Stand there or sit at my feet,' have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" Again, you can see this is clearly drawn from the teaching of Jesus. It doesn't preserve the teaching in exact verbal form, but there can be no doubt of the reliance. Jesus, in Luke 6, verse 25, says, "Woe to you that are full now, for you shall hunger. Woe to you that laugh now, for you shall mourn." And in James chapter 4, verse 9, you can see him saying, or we can read him, "Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to dejection." So he takes really the teaching of Jesus, which those two woes that he pronounces, and he applies them to the congregation he's writing to. In Matthew 6:19, we've got the very famous passage, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal." And over in James chapter 5, verse 2, "Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten." Anyways, there's a dozen or so, at least, reliances that James has on the teaching that we find in the Gospels. So again, in the letter of James, we've got more allusions, not exact quotations, but very clear allusions to the sayings of Jesus than any other New Testament document outside the four Gospels. Now we have St. Paul, whose documents are really the earliest documents we have in the New Testament. He wrote between 48 and, say, 64, 65. And he occasionally refers to details from Jesus' earthly life. Now, he doesn't spend a lot of time on this. That isn't what he's doing. He's building churches, and he's trying to solve problems with them. But he does have occasion, of course, to refer to the earthly life of Jesus. He talks about Jesus as a descendant from King David. He uses Jesus' teaching when he's instructing missionaries and when he teaches about marriage, love, and the treatment of enemies. Clearly, his instruction is taken from Jesus. The institution of the Eucharist is, again, drawn from what we see in the Gospels. It was the same tradition. Paul's drawing from the very same tradition that the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, are drawing from. He refers to Jesus' execution, his burial, the betrayal, the resurrection, the appearances of Jesus after the crucifixion, after the resurrection. He refers to Jesus, of course, as the Jewish Messiah. And it's interesting to note that Luke, the Gospel writer Luke, is actually Paul's traveling companion through portions of the Acts of the Apostles. You hear this was written by Luke as well, and there are a number of places where Luke says, "We did this, we did that." He's referring to himself and St. Paul. Luke, in the prologue to his gospel, really gives us an amazing outline of his sources. He says that he's consulted with various eyewitnesses and those who are ministers of the word. Historical accuracy is very important to him. Luke was well-equipped to write history, and the form his history took arose not out of his imagination, it arose out of the historical events themselves. And some scholars believe that Luke may have even used material from Mark, chapter 13, in editing his 21st chapter describing the signs at the end of the age. I'll have more to say about Luke a little bit later. But Matthew and Luke do repeat considerable material from Mark. But there's material that Luke and Matthew quote that isn't in Mark. Where did it come from? Scholars posit an independent source that they call Q. Now, we don't have any documents of Q, so this is a projection. This is to help account for the common stories in Luke and Matthew that are not found in Mark. Now, there are portions of Luke's gospel as well, which are unique to him, and they don't display his traditional writing style. So scholars believe that he had a special source called L, and it contains the parables like the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, the story of Zacchaeus, the forgiving of the prostitute. And none of that material appears in any of the other gospels. Now, some people wonder about the Gospel of John. Most people think it's the last to be written. But it relies upon, it's constructed very artfully. You have seven signs, great miracles identifying Jesus. You have seven I am statements. The Gospel of John shows that he wasn't just a stenographer following Jesus, although it does claim to be eyewitness testimony. But this was very artfully constructed to demonstrate that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, a lot of people wonder about the infancy narratives. Joseph, Mary, of course, had to be the original sources for those stories. There were no other human beings there. And yet, when you look at the infancy narratives in Matthew and in Luke, they really do read quite differently, and they cover different material, which makes me think that they, you know, that Mary and Joseph didn't sit down with Matthew and Luke and give them the whole story. So I don't know exactly what the transmission is there. They had to originally come from Mary and Joseph, but most married couples, when they tell stories, they kind of gel together. That's not true with the infancy narratives in Matthew and Luke. That's why I think they come from a different line of tradition. Yeah, the sourcing for the Gospels is incredible in the ancient world. And this is what I actually resent a bit, that we don't let people know how extraordinarily firm are the writings of the New Testament. I'll give you an example. If you want to know something about Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, you have to rely on sources that are 350 years after his death. The writings of Judaism's most famous rabbi, Hillel, he lived about 100 BC to 10 AD, and we don't have any of his writings until about 200 AD. Muhammad, his first biography appears 75 years after his, or 125 years, excuse me, after his death. And then they edited that for another 50 years. With Jesus, we actually have information going back to within, I think, months of the crucifixion and resurrection. In St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, the tradition that he's passing on in the first nine verses there are taken, I think, from the earliest possible sources. That's the preaching of the apostles on Pentecost. Sometimes Christians get a little queasy about all these different sources. They shouldn't. The more witnesses, the more secure the reporting. And Luke's a good example of a writer who's drawing upon multiple sources. He notes when he has a patron named Theophilus, and he's writing to his patron, and he says, "Let me tell you where I'm drawing my material." He says there are other written accounts, many other written accounts, and so he's certainly drawing from those written accounts. He also speaks of the eyewitnesses that he has consulted with, and he also talks about servants of the word or ministers of the word, which is a technical phrase referring to those who are the guardians of the oral tradition. These are memorized reports of the things that Jesus did and said in the presence of his followers. Now, sometimes people get uncomfortable with oral tradition because we live in a very literary culture. We print things. So when we want to preserve important stuff, we print it out. That wasn't true in the ancient world. It was an oral culture. And this means that people learn important material not by reading it or writing it, but by hearing it. And so recollections of Jesus' life and teachings became fixed very early on. And the ideal disciple in the rabbinic tradition was, it was remarked of the ideal disciple, that he was like a cistern that is not broken. He loses not a drop. So the good disciple was one that remembered the master's teaching and lost nothing.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother. This commandment enjoins on us young children not only obedience to their parents and even older children, great honor for them, but also gratitude for all of our elders, teachers, employers, and leaders. It also directs citizens to a proper love of our country. So it's a rich commandment. And it also puts great requirements on those who are in those positions to be worthy of the honor that is due them. This commandment is fundamentally given to us by God because without respect for our elders, there can be no teaching, and we cannot hand on the wisdom of previous generations. This commandment is rich and it is for us. The fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
What makes an act moral or immoral? The Catechism of the Catholic Church lays out specific criteria for us to follow. When he acts deliberately, man is, so to speak, the father of his acts. Acts freely chosen can be morally evaluated as either good or evil. The sources on which the morality of an act are determined are three. 1, the object chosen. 2, the intent of the act. 3, the circumstances surrounding the act. To be moral, the object of the act itself must be good and the intention pure. The circumstances are secondary to the first two criteria. They can increase or diminish the morality of the act. For instance, stealing a candy bar is wrong, but far less evil than robbing a bank. Intent and circumstance, however, cannot change the moral quality of the act itself. The end does not justify the means. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
With so much going on in the world, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. What do you need to know today? Stay tuned to Cresta in the Afternoon and Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo as we bring you the day's top stories and conversations from an authentic Catholic perspective. Never miss an episode of Cresta in the Afternoon. Subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand at AveMariaRadio.net and on the Ave Maria Radio app.
Do you wish you could have discussions about difficult topics with your adult children? If so, don't worry. You're not alone. Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. And our new book, Having Meaningful, Sometimes Difficult Conversations with Your Adult Sons and Daughters, can help you draw closer to your adult children and help guide them on the path to more faithful and meaningful lives.
You can get our latest book and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 75% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org. Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria mutual funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me today. All my adult life, my Christian life anyways, heard people talking about culture, technology, information, entertainment, and exactly what is a proper Christian approach to any of these particular areas. And the discussion almost never gets beyond saying, oh, technology, yes, there's a downside to it, but you've got to remember it's really a blessing. But you say, well, how do we guard against the downside of it? And not many people are able to give you many guidelines except, well, just watch it. And this is true, too, with entertainment choices. Unless you're willing to draw hard lines, most people simply say, yeah, it's there, generally good, but you got to watch it, too. Well, my guest, Andy Crouch, has actually given a lot more thought to technology, and he's given us some everyday steps for putting technology in its proper place. It's a book called The TechWise Family, and Andy is the his work's been featured in Time, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. He's executive editor, or was executive editor at Christianity Today from 2012 to 2016, and now is a senior strategist for communications at the John Templeton Foundation. Andy, good to have you with me.
Hello, Al. It's so great to be with you.
I'm so glad you wrote this because people have been talking and commenting about technology for a long time, and then we actually had the explosion of the computer age and now the internet, and parents are still trying to figure out what their relationship is to technology, and you've given us some good guidelines here. What is the first problem that a parent has to come to grips with when they begin to think about their family culture in technology?
Well, I think it's a very fundamental problem, and it's not the first thing most people think of. I mean, honestly, what most people think of first is kind of racy content, violent or sexual
right.
content online that they don't want their kids to see at an inappropriate age,
right.
and some of it is not appropriate at any age. But there's
true.
Something deeper, I think, and it's more fundamental, and it's really goes to the heart of what family is for. And in this book, The TechWise Family, I say that the thing that we need family for is to form wisdom and character. And wisdom is knowing the deep truth about myself, God, and the world. And character is the ability to actually live in response to that deep truth. And the problem is technology, which is good for all kinds of things and can be used in good ways in the home.
Sure.
If we're not careful, it prevents us from that kind of prime directive of family because it can easily be a substitute for developing deep knowledge of ourselves and others and God because it makes everything very, it can make a lot of things at least very easy. But we all know growth doesn't come from things that are easy, from
right.
life that is easy. And so we as parents have to be careful we're not making things easy that actually rob our children and ourselves of the chance to develop wisdom and character.
I think you're right. People, first of all, when they think about the internet, use of computers, they're first wanting to screen out the outrageous, morally outrageous content that's their pornography and things of that sort. But the question
yep.
goes beyond that. It's the very use of technology itself and what it does to shape us. For instance, I noticed this early on when the internet came out, and that is I have an active mind and I'm curious, and I found myself hours following mindlessly from one website to another, learning, oh, I never knew that. That's great. Oh, I never knew that either. Gee, what a funny thing. Maybe I can put them together somehow. Hours go by, and I realize I haven't written a thing. I haven't really
wow.
researched anything either. I've just kind of been titillated by these curiosities. And I've found
wow.
distraction being one of the biggest problems I've had with the internet.
That's so right. And I wish that it was only your problem. But and what I think is very telling in what you said is that you realized you were not creating anything yourself. You were just
right.
consuming what other people had created.
Yeah.
And you actually were not consuming on a very deep level. You used the word research. And research is the kind of going deeply into something.
Right.
But the temptation of all kinds of technologies that surround us now is they give us the option to consume rather than create. and to consume at a shallow level rather than really contemplating or meditating on or really growing in the knowledge of something, which is really where wisdom comes from.
Yes.
So, you know, a big mistake we often make with all kinds of culture, I certainly see it with entertainment, is we fixate on the content when, in fact, it's the form it comes to us
exactly.
in that is most powerful. It's not so much what's on the screen, bad or good or healthy or unhealthy, or, you know, it's the fact that my attention is occupied by a screen. And
that's
what's
right.
that doing to me? And what am I missing out on that I could be doing if that screen were not so captivating and so easy to use?
This is of a great concern to me. I have five children. I still have a 15-year-old at home. And I've noticed with each of my children, it's been more difficult to deal with this technology issue. And I think what I fear the most is this, especially with the youngest one who's with us in the home now, because he's never had a time. He's grown up with this. It's been part of who he is. And he never, in my case, I grew up at a time where I understood what it was like to go to the library and work for hours trying to track down things, write things down, create with the material I was given. He's never had a period of life where that was natural. It's always been something you had to do as a self-imposed discipline. Most of his friends are free to just cruise around and you know, look at the internet and do what they want with it and call it work. I think that's the problem, because if you don't have a backdrop, I think that's what I'm most concerned about, is that younger people today don't grow up at a time in which it's normal to do creative writing early on, where it's normal to have to do research and consult encyclopedia articles and compare different people's perspectives on things. We get pre-digested packages of data online.
Yes.
But is that affecting the difference in generations here?
I think you're absolutely right that there is the option now to sort of surf through life, or maybe skim through life would be the best word.
Yeah.
I think the good news is all of those old ways of learning are still available.
That's
none
right.
of them has disappeared.
Right.
There's still a guitar somewhere in a closet somewhere, rather than
yep.
playing Guitar Hero or whatever the latest version
yep.
of those games is. There are still books. And by the way, I'll give you one encouraging little piece of news, which is that the younger you are in America, the more you prefer to read a printed book. So that is to say, older adults have been faster to adopt electronic readers like the Kindle and so forth,
yeah.
sometimes because it's easier on the
sure.
eyes as your
sure.
eyes age. But younger readers actually still love books.
And is that so?
I think when you give kids the option and give them a little bit of room to realize how fulfilling kind of real-world, three-dimensional, full-body engagement is, even reading a book, you're holding it, you're flipping the pages. We have very clear evidence from studies now that you retain more when you read in physical form than just a glowing rectangle on a screen. and you this in my family, we just call them all glowing rectangles, the little ones, the big ones.
That's good.
And they're not that satisfying, and kids can learn that, and even kids who have grown up kind of in this fully digitally immersed world can change. And the beautiful thing about the human brain is we actually can relearn pretty quickly,
yeah,
and
yeah.
learn again the real satisfactions of that more fully embodied life that I as a Christian think we were made for in the first place.
Yeah Very good. I hadn't heard that. I have a library of hard copy books, about 30,000 books, and I probably have 20,000.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and I have about 20,000 on, you know, books, you know, Kindle, the digital
yeah.
library. And I was afraid that in the future, hard copy books would go by the wayside. The nice thing about books that you can handle and smell, you
sure.
read them by holding them, and there's a feel to them. The
oh,
pages
yeah.
are cut a certain way. They're a certain diameter. There's, you know, the design of the cover means something. And you remember better, too. I think that's the hard thing with these digital books is that, you know, I've started to learn how to highlight on them. So that's I feel better about that. But but I still would prefer to have a pen in my hand and underline and write in the margins.
No, that's right. And I think what you're experiencing is that digital books are useful. The more utilitarian something is, the more it's basically fine to turn it into a technological form. That is, you know, certain kinds of books that you're only going to read one time or that just have a few simple points that you want to glean, where you would use a highlighter. You know, even the difference between a highlighter and a pen is huge in learning, because a highlighter, all that lets you do is sort of be a super consumer. That is, you're sort of picking out the parts of the text that seem to matter to you or seem most important to you. But a pen or a pencil allows you to actually interact and to, in a sense, to write back in the margin of a physical book. And that's not so easy to do with digital. And I would guess that when you, or really any real reader, wants to go deep with something, you're going to want that printed book, because it allows for multiple readings. It's a much more cognitively rich experience. And this is a good principle for our homes, I think. You know, in my home, there's lots of technology in our home, as there is in almost every sort of middle-class American home.
Sure.
But we try to use it only for the things that are marginal to our lives, that are not the central things we do. And actually, in our home, we've made sure that the central space in our home is almost, you basically can't see any technology. There's still Wi-Fi waves in the air and so forth. But we fill the center of our home with things that reward that kind of deep, three-dimensional, embodied activity for parents and for children. And we push the flat, glowing things to the edge of the house and use them just for utilitarian purposes, not for the real stuff of life.
So, I mean, so do you have to pull the television out when you want to watch it?
Well, the way we do it, it's in the basement. And the basement is, you know, not bad. It's a finished basement, but it's not the central room in the house.
Right.
And, and you know, folks will come in and they'll be very confused, because in most of our homes, not in our house, it's hidden away.
They don't know where East is if the television isn't there. Andy, hold it there. We'll come back on the other side of the break. My guest, Andy Crouch, is the author most recently of The TechWise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at solidarityhealthshare.org or at 844-313-4999.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I want you to have such confidence in the Lord that you'll find such hope and see the beauty of the Lord, the majesty of God. What did our Lord say, huh? If your sins are as scarlet, what? What's going to happen? They shall be made white as snow.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
Vatican II teaches that every baptized person is a participant in the threefold office of Jesus, which is priest, prophet, and king. So as priest, Christ is a sanctifier. He effects a reconciliation between divinity and humanity, right, by his great sacrifice on the cross. Every baptized person does indeed participate in that, in the measure that we all have that calling to reconcile divinity and humanity, to bring God to people and people to God. That's true of every baptized person. Vatican II further specifies that the ordained priesthood is different, not only in degree, but in kind. And it has to do with the identification between the ordained priest, I think, and the Mass, and a unique relationship to the sacraments. Every baptized person has a task of reconciling divinity and humanity. The ordained priest does it in this sort of heightened sacramental and Eucharistic way.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I discipline consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Andy Crouch, the author most recently of The TechWise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place. You looked at recent findings from the Barna Research Group into the role that technology plays in American families. Was there anything in that research that surprised you?
Well, I have to say most of it confirmed what we all kind of know from looking around, which is technology is everywhere now, and yeah, smartphones are really the way that it's changed so right, rapidly, and families are really desperately trying to figure out how to handle this. And I guess one thing that was very striking in the research is when you ask parents what makes raising kids most challenging today, their number one answer by a significant margin is managing all the technology that they and their kids have access to. Here's a more surprising finding, though. It's not just the parents who feel like it's a problem. When you ask teenagers what is something they wish were different in their relationship with their parents, the single most common answer is, I wish my mom or dad would stop looking at their phone and would talk to me.
Really?
So that's the teens who are saying, you know, mom and dad, you're not paying attention. And so this actually goes both ways. I think it's really a mistake to frame this as a problem with the kids. You know, it's kids these days. You know, well, it's about parents these days. And most of the time when we introduce technology into our kids' lives, whether it's giving them a smartphone or handing them a DVD or like an iPad to watch in the back of the car, it's not actually to solve one of their problems. It's actually to solve our problems.
Yeah.
But we're actually handing them something that is really going to, if we're not very careful, cause them to miss out on some of the best things and some of the hard things, which are also some of the best things
right,
of family life.
Yeah. Why is boredom good for kids?
You know, this is, I think every parent probably, well, for many decades, if not centuries, has had to deal with kids complaining that they're bored.
Right.
I remember going to my mom with that very complaint when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. And my mom had great wisdom, she just had sort of the ordinary wisdom to realize that a bored kid is a kid who needs to be sent out to play and to learn how not to be bored, because on the other side of boredom is real creativity and discovery.
Mm-hmm.
I work as a writer with part of my life, and mm-hmm, the truth is, in order to be a creative person, whether it's in writing or music or really any kind of accomplishment, you have to learn to sit through a certain amount of tedium. There's this moment when you're writing, when the screen is blank,
yep,
there's nothing on it. It's so easy if you decide, oh, I'm bored, why don't I do something? Well, you are now missing out on the very moment when you're going to start to be creative. And, nice. And parents have always had to push their kids in this direction, at least for many generations
yeah.
now. But now we have options. Both parents and children have options to use these devices that will relieve that feeling of boredom, but without asking any creativity from us.
Mm.
And I think that's a real loss. I think we're losing out on the wonder and delight of childhood, which is being able to go out in the backyard and even just, I live in a nice little suburb here. There's nothing especially extraordinary about our backyard. But we used to send our kids out there to play, and for the first 15 minutes, they'd be bored, and then they'd be out there for 3 more hours
yep.
discovering things, in the dirt and
yep.
the bark of the trees.
Yep.
So it's good for kids to learn how to handle that, because on the other side of it is real life, actually.
No, I absolutely. And I remember when our children, we had our first children, they were quite young, this question of boredom, coming up, and my wife saying to them, look, you're bored. I'm not bored, but you're bored. So well, why am I not bored and you're bored? Why don't you figure that out? You know, and the kids have turned out fine, by the way. So
yes, it's good to, I've written this book at a point where my children are late teenagers, and so I know that I didn't completely mess them up. At about age 10, none of us is an expert on parenting.
Right,
if you
right.
hang on, But I actually think the more you entertain someone, the more easily bored they will become.
I agree.
Entertainment it's not wrong to be entertained, but it doesn't teach us how to entertain ourselves. Mm-hmm. And especially as children, we actually need limited entertainment so that we can discover kind of the deeper delights of life, which healthy adults have learned that there's a way to be interested in almost anything. And I'll also say our modern world is boring in a way that for most of human history, the world wasn't. The world was a lot more fearsome and terrifying for much of history, but it also was much more full of rich experience. And, a peasant family in the Middle Ages would not have had a lawn, which is a pretty boring thing. They would have had meadows, I suppose,
yes.
or forests.
Yeah.
And the kids would play in those places. And that was probably a better life in certain respects.
My guest is Andy Crouch. He's the author most recently of The TechWise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place. I wanted to ask you about that. Is it because modern culture is more homogeneous? Is it less peaks and valleys? More image conscious? Are we in an electronic cocoon, and so we're not able to get out and experience life as it is?
Well, I think there might be two things here. One is I do actually think the modern world is a much more sensory experience of life in our world, our technologized world, is actually very thin. The number of aromas we experience on a given day, the different kinds of things we'll see have all been limited. And there's some evidence actually that the rise of autoimmune disorders in children actually is related to the fact that children encounter so many fewer kinds of environments than they used to. They used to play in the dirt, and now we have micro antibacterial surfaces everywhere.
Yeah, yes, yes.
The other thing is we're surrounded by very carefully designed stimulation.
Right.
And in a way, without even thinking about it, you and I are contributing to this because we're doing radio here. And one of the principles of radio is no dead air.
Right.
That is, if I stop talking, you start. And we make sure that we're offering our listeners a kind of continuous stream of conversation. Well, that would not be at all like what life used to be like. There would have been silence in conversations. And this is still true in person. But the mediated world sort of amps everything up. And certainly look at how visual communication has changed.
Yeah.
And even what television looks like today compared to just 20 years ago, let alone 50 years ago when it first was introduced. The speed of cuts, the vividness of the colors, the definition on the screen, all these things give us this expectation for a kind of vivid life that is more vivid than the real world. But that actually makes us more capable of being bored rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah, the number of technical changes in a 60-second commercial is extraordinary. It's actually, Sally and I have talked about this, it makes me uncomfortable sometimes. I don't know, what did I just see there? I'm not sure I know. Half the time, I don't know what's being advertised either, which is kind of, I think the designers, the advertisers are too clever by half. But I do think that there's this, again, this mediated world that we're living in, that I think it does clear away a lot of life's hard edges, sharp corners. I wanted to ask about the ways that you can create a low-tech living space. You mentioned what you've done with your family. What are some other things we can do?
Well, I'd start with the place where your family spends the most time together, wherever that is. For us, it's kind of, we have an open first floor in a small house, and that's where most of life happens. And I would actually take an inventory of that space, and anything that is a device, that is something that does something for you and doesn't ask anything of you. So I would try to replace that as much as possible with something that actually requires skill and engagement. So we do this even with the lighting in our first floor. When we sit down to dinner, most nights when it's this time of year or in the winter time of year, we turn off the electric lights and the kids get to compete for who lights the candles at the table.
Huh.
And I will tell you, dinner changes. Just an ordinary, everybody's busy coming in like a Wednesday evening.
Yeah.
But you light those candles, you turn off those electric lights, you actually took there's a little bit of risk in fire. It's mesmerizing in a way that electric light isn't, and it glows in this beautiful way.
Hmm.
And it's a wonderful way to have a dinner. And why not do that every night you sit down for dinner? That's what we decided to do. Rely more on the stove than the microwave, because the stove requires you to develop skill in cooking, whereas the microwave doesn't really ask anything of you that a three-year-old can't do.
Right.
And I actually think, part of the reason children may seem less respectful of their parents these days is they don't really see their parents doing anything worthy of respect.
When
a kid can push a button just as well as an adult.
Yeah.
But there are things we adults know how to do that are actually quite admirable and beautiful. And our kids could see us doing those things in those central living spaces of our home. And then we'd actually have something to teach them and something to celebrate as a family.
Is it nice to have a piano there?
Well, we do. We have a grand piano, partly because that was my training. And I taught both of our kids. And that was a big investment. We used our kids' college savings because we figured, any kid can go to college, but not every kid can grow up with a grand piano. But
before
we had that piano, we had an old upright that we salvaged. People will actually pay you to take pianos away these days. And for our little children at that point, that was just this symbol, that they could walk up to. Not much you could do to hurt it
as
a 3 or 4-year-old. But it says you're going to learn to create something with your life rather than you're just going to be a consumer your whole life.
Should spouses have each other's passwords? Should parents have total access to their kids' devices?
I think the more sin thrives in secrecy.
Right. I agree.
And foolishness does, too. And foolishness leads to sin. And the more we have other people who know all of our foolishness and all of our temptations to foolishness, the better off we are. I just got a funny little message from someone I don't know, but her daughter had been in a meeting with me and told her mom that I looked cute. And she sent me this message saying, he's really cute. And I read it aloud to my wife. And I said, I'm going to read you this whole thing because you need to know exactly what I got in my Twitter message here. So that there's no secret there, nothing that I'd cherish about that,
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I encourage parents and children, parents to know with each other and to know with their kids all the silly, wonderful stuff and all the temptations to foolishness as well.
Andy, thank you so much. Great talking with you. I hope we can talk again.
I do too. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Andy Crouch, the book is called The TechWise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place. Again, every book I mention here you can get at the website.
Nestled under the warm Florida sun is a university whose name indicates a vocational call. Ave Maria, Latin for Hail Mary, recalls the angel Gabriel's announcement to Mary of her future vocation, becoming the Mother of God. Enriched by God's grace, Mary freely ascends to this call. This is the model for all students. Come to Ave Maria University, where you'll be empowered to clearly see your vocational call, whatever that call might be. Ave Maria University, your vocation location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Thank you for being with us over the last 2 hours, and Lord willing, I will be back tomorrow with lots more to talk about. But from today, if you are interested in today's program or learning more about today's guests, go to AveMariaRadio.net. We will have linked for you there Luis Marcos's books, Putting Atheism on Trial, and also his new book on connecting Christian spirituality to the Greek and Roman myths. Also, at the online bookstore at our website, we'll have Andy Crouch's book, The TechWise Family, Everyday Steps for Putting Technology in Its Proper Place. As we go off the air, Catholic Answers Live is ready to take your calls. And then all throughout tomorrow, we'll have special coverage of the March for Life. EWTN Radio and Television will be there live, giving it the attention it deserves. Teresa Tomei is going to be there broadcasting, doing some of her own reporting and interviews. And then it wraps up mid-afternoon, so we'll be doing our regular program here on Cresta in the afternoon, but we will include some interviews with people over there, as well as talking with Kevin Wells about the really remarkable life of Father Aloysius Schwartz, known to his friends as Father Al, who gave his life serving with the poorest of the poor all over the world. Also tomorrow, I have some of our continued reactions to the first year of President Biden's time in office, and some of the good, the bad, and the ugly of yesterday's press conference, which, of course, is getting a lot of attention as well. Until then, if you go to AveMariaRadio.net, there's more to do there. You can check out our featured articles, our poll of the week, go to the slider for the latest information about everybody attending the March for Life. And, of course, you can sign up for our email list there as well. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Subscribe to our channel on YouTube as we continue to produce videos there. And from all of us at Crest in the Afternoon, have a great rest of your evening. We'll see you tomorrow, and God bless.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.